Langenberg of St. Louis. Harry was really an illustration of what the Philadelphia Society, no, more than that, the conservative movement in America has really been. Wonderful. Something that has grown organically, democratically, out of the soil of this land. Not a movement pressed down from above, but something that has grown up as intelligent people have sat with great texts from biblical and classical antiquity to the founding documents of this republic and other materials and applied them to analysis of their own life experiences. So was Harry in 1955 creating the St. Louis Discussion Club, an early form of what has evolved into things such as the Philadelphia Society, yeoman citizens getting together to discuss great issues and seeing their application to real life. Well, I'm sorry to report our colleague, member of the society, Harry, passed away a little more than a week ago at the ripe age of 96. Harry was an inveterate wearer of bow ties, and the bow tie I'm wearing was made by him. It is of material he obtained from Norma Lipsett, the Adam Smith cloth, and I wear it in his memory and his honor, and I know those of you who were his friends will miss him. Those of you who never had the privilege of knowing him yet reap the benefit of his initiative and innovation in meetings such as this. In the good news department, just a couple of months ago, a fellow who's attended more meetings of the Philadelphia Society than I can count, a Roman Catholic priest who is both a social traditionalist and a free market guy and yet has never been run out of any diocese, celebrated the 55th anniversary of his ordination, the ripe old age of 86. One of the people, he was kind enough to invite my wife Kathy and me to come celebrate with him, but one of the people who came was the retired Bishop of Little Rock, Arkansas, Bishop McDonald. I know Bishop McDonald kept making these massive arm gestures, intersecting arm gestures over Father Franz Jordan in the course of this thing. I finally said, "Bishop McDonald, what are you doing?" And he said, "Ah, I'm crossing Jordan." For the purposes of our invocation, it's a real pleasure to call on a longtime friend of the Philadelphia Society, the Reverend Franz Jordan.
Thank you, Joe. Nobody ever told me the reason the society is called the Philadelphia Society, but I presume it's because we have great admiration for two documents that came out of Philadelphia: the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And we cherish those documents. And I'd just like to comment on a phrase from the Declaration of Independence and go through the meaning of that. All men are created equal. All men. Of course, we know in different languages the word man is like in Latin, Greek, the same words for feminine and the masculine. To create means to bring out of nothing. But we have bodies and souls. Our body came from our parents, in which they gave themselves physically, totally to each other. And we came into existence. So we came out of that. And that's our bodies. Our souls were created by God, each and every one of us. That soul was created individually. It's for us. God had us in mind, and he keeps us in mind. If he forgot us for a moment, we would go out of existence. But he created our soul in his own image and likeness. Essentially, God has two powers, the intellect and the free will. The intellect, which we should use in our search for truth, and the free will, in which we assert that we sent to that truth and carry it into action. And so our freedom, our equality, comes from our souls, not from our bodies. Physically, our bodies are different. Some people are born into this world with health conditions, others very fine conditions. Some into families with many material resources, some with few. So there's no equality there. But but it's in our soul that we're equal. And that's what makes us a human being. Animals don't have human souls. And it's the dignity of the human being that is so important, that we regard each person, no matter what his external circumstances may be, as somebody is very important, very essential, and we respect that person. And if I might get personal, 6 days before my 15th birthday, my father died suddenly. My father was a person whose theme was, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. His work involved seeing salesmen, and sometimes those salesmen had to come 50, 60 miles to see him, and when they were announced, you know, he couldn't buy from them, but he always took time to see them. The respect he had for every person. And that's what's so important in all that we do. It's the human person that's important. It's the human person we're trying to serve. And in our search for the right way to adjust all the economics, all the aspects of society, we must always keep in mind the human person. Because God loves us, and he loves us for being what we are.
To that we say amen, enjoy lunch, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Keep eating. If you're eating, enjoy dessert. Keep drinking coffee, tea, and the like. And the servers, please keep clearing and don't mind me. Father Jordan was absolutely right in his speculation as to where the Philadelphia Society gets its name. It is named because of the high admiration that the founders and members of this organization have had for the documents that emerged in Philadelphia in the last quarter century of the 18th, last quarter of the 18th century. And as a reminder, although the Philadelphia Society is not rooted or created in Philadelphia, it does return there from time to time. And the 2006 annual meeting will be held in the very early spring in Philadelphia. And Gene Hickok, known to President Bush as Wild Bill, who loves to give nicknames to people, Gene Hickok reminds us of the new National Constitution Center at Philadelphia, and certainly commend that to both attendance at the annual meeting and visit to the center to all of you next year. I spoke in opening the luncheon with some sadness about the loss of Harry Langenberg, but I am pleased to announce today some very happy news involving the Philadelphia Society and one of our members. Jackie Schaefer, a longtime member of the Philadelphia Society, was nominated by the sitting President Bush to be Assistant Administrator of USAID for Policy. And in its wisdom, we believe, the Senate of the United States confirmed her yesterday. So it shows some wisdom in Washington. Now, hope you enjoyed this lunch. There is some news out of Washington this morning. Shortly before giving his weekly Saturday radio address, President Bush had breakfast this morning with Vice President Cheney at the White House, and serving them was a wonderful woman, Patricia Walton. You may know her. She was recruited into the White House mess staff during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, and a lot of us who know Patricia are very fond of her. President Bush calls her Patty Cakes. And this morning when she took Vice President Cheney's order, Vice President Cheney ordered his usual heart-healthy oatmeal and raisins. She turned to the president, and the president said, "Patty Cakes, how about a quickie?" Ms. Walton was truly dismayed, and she said, very serious, no respecter of persons, she said to the president, "Mr. President, I got that kind of thing for 8 solid years every day from that horrible Bill Clinton, but I never thought that I would hear that from you." And Vice President Cheney leaned over and said, Mr. President, it's pronounced quiche. Sorry. The president may in fact suffer from dyslexia, some forms of learning disability. Another illustration just happened this last week or so. The president called a news conference to announce an appointment, and he had the paper in front of him with the name Janice Rogers Brown on it, and he read Harriet Myers. So go figure. As I said, the president is very fond of giving people nicknames. Every time he sees Tim Wheeler, he says, "Hey, Wheelie." We heard Wheelie last night speak of the rise of the progressive movement in Wisconsin, the roots of this toxin in this state, curiously omitted from Tim's remarks, and it was noted by Jameson campaign that it was omitted, was any reference to the counterpart Wisconsin movement, the celebrated regressive movement, who, as Robert La Follette is the patron saint of the progressive movement, so tail gunner Joe McCarthy is the patron saint of the Wisconsin regressive movement. And although Stan Evans was not able to be here today, whenever the name of Joe McCarthy crops up, Stan Evans, of course, always observes, well, I can't say that I agreed with his goals, but you have to admire his methods. Whenever the president sees David Boaz, he says, "Hey, Bozy." Whenever he sees Lee Edwards, he says, "Hey, Eddie." Whenever he sees Gene Smiley, he says, "Hey, Smiley." Sometimes he's creative in this. As evidenced by just a week or two ago, the president was in Louisiana. He just passing by Bill Campbell's street, passing out FEMA debit cards, gave a couple of FEMA debit cards to Bill Campbell. Now, Bill at the time was very busy preparing for this meeting. And if you stop and think about it, Bill Campbell should be the director of FEMA. I mean, first of all, think of how effortlessly he runs meetings of the Philadelphia Society. Arrange a meal? Flick a meal. Arrange speakers? Flick speakers. Arrange to put bags in the room and close the door? Flick. Suddenly, it happens. And as it turned out, Bill is also a master of contingency planning. And when President Bush, passing out the FEMA debit cards, happened on Bill last week, Bill was right there writing a contingency speech in case Steve Moore didn't show up. And he also, Bill is incredible. He wrote a contingency speech in case Joe Morris didn't show up. He wrote a contingency speech in case Paul Ryan didn't show up. Bill writes contingency speeches in case he doesn't show up. And the president said to Campbell, "Soupy, you're doing a great job." So, Soupy, you're doing a great job. Topic of this meeting, progressivism and its consequences and the possibilities of reversing all or part of those consequences, of course, fits into a crucial mission of this society, which is the preservation and more the vindication of the American Constitution and its vision of the American experiment. I carried around, David, please report, I'm carrying the Cato edition of the Constitution. Now, some in this room have observed that the problems, the hell that we are putting the people of Iraq through in their efforts to adopt a constitution are really quite needless. We really ought to offer to the people of Iraq the use of the American Constitution, since we're not using it. But there is something about our Constitution that I would like to put in play in the discussion as we carry on the rest of this session. And I'll get there by way of a brief detour into Europe. For we see in Europe right now probably the tail end of the current phase of a constitutional debate. The Europeans wrestling with what kind of a political order to establish on a continent-wide basis. And as we see them flailing in that effort, I respectfully submit that what we are discerning is the baleful influence of the movement that in this country goes by the label of progressivism, and in Europe has achieved a remarkable flowering in an effort to create government by administrative fiat, administrative bodies and measures, and the wisdom of experts, far removed from the organic Burkean kind of prudence of any one of the national societies of Europe, and perhaps this is the thing that pleases the progressives most, completely divorced from democratic accountability, either through national political mechanisms or continent-wide political mechanisms. If there is in the world today a model of progressivism as a cancer even more widely metastasized and doing even deeper damage to a culture and to the roots of democratic politics, it may be what we are seeing in Western, now increasingly Central and Eastern Europe today. Certainly, if one were going to create a common market, if that were one's goal, there are easier and cheaper ways to do it than to create the European Union. And one way, for example, would be to do something along the lines of what the framers did in Philadelphia in adopting the Constitution of the United States when they produced the Full Faith and Credit Clause. Now, I'll confer the Harriet Myers Prize in Constitutional Scholarship on anyone who can stand up and quote the Full Faith and Credit Clause from memory. Well, that's all right. I have a feeling that the we may be seeing a Senate Judiciary Committee with pop quizzes along those lines coming very soon on national television. It's Article 4, Section 2, and it says, "The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states." Now think how simple that language is and how simple the idea is. And if what you had in mind in Europe was the creation of a common market, even while preserving a thoroughgoing common market, even while preserving existing political institutions and diversity of social and cultural and political structures, nation state by nation state, participating in the common market, how simple it would be to adopt basically a kind of a one-page charter for such a common market that simply said, with respect to activity in any one nation state that is a member of the community, and in particular with respect to the ownership or exchange of property and the taxation of ownership and exchange within that nation state, citizens of all member states will be treated within that member state as if they were citizens, period. So that a Frenchman in Denmark could buy, sell, own property and be taxed on it, whatever kind of property, real or personal, of any kind, tangible or intangible, just as if he were a Dane, and otherwise Denmark would be completely free to adopt any political structures, laws, taxes, local rules it wanted. It's simply a question of, well, to borrow again from Father Jordan's observation, conferring equality for that purpose, for the purpose of ownership and exchange upon members of all the units inside that country. By contrast, if what you wanted was complete national unity, that is, creating a supernation that was politically unified with a unified continent-wide democratic system, there'd be a much simpler and more direct way to achieve that, too, wouldn't there, by direct and overt union, rather than this bizarre hybrid of government by experts coming out of Brussels. So how did Europe get in this sad way, since it didn't have the direct influence of Bob La Follette or the American New Deal? I'm going to answer that question, but first I'm going to commend Morton Blackwell, the Leadership Institute, for teaching us, and particularly teaching young people, over and over again, many simple lessons that are really very valuable. And one of them is, a Morton Blackwell rule, always carry a book. You never know when you're going to have downtime. You never know when you're going to be stuck waiting for a plane. You never know when you're going to be sitting there with some boring speaker or professor speaking, and you can sneak a read, do something valuable with your time, and have a book. The Bill Campbell Amendment to the Morton Blackwell rule is Bill carries a book even when he's giving the lecture, because he's never sure when he's going to bore himself. Following Bill Campbell's rule, Bill Campbell's amendment to the Morton Blackwell rule, I brought a book to my talk, which I commend to all of you. It's Richard Holmes's recent biography of Winston Churchill, In the Footsteps of Churchill. And it's kind of an answer to some of Churchill's recent revisionist critics. To show you where the author is coming from, Richard Holmes, let me quote just one passage that's particularly felicitous and brief. It will resonate in this society, among whose founders were von Mises and Hayek. In the middle of the book, Holmes writes, "Free trade is the principal instrument of creative destruction in any economy." What a happy thought that is. Free trade is the principal instrument of creative destruction in any economy. Holmes, in this book, gives us some insight into the mentality of the progressives of America and of their European counterparts in the early part of the 20th century, with this wonderful anecdote about how after World War I, Churchill, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, presided over a debate whether or not to return to the gold standard. One of the most treasured myths of the British left, writes Holmes, is that restoration of sterling to the gold standard in 1925 was a slap in the face of British working men. Instead, he argues, it was an effort to knave-proof the economy. That is, to make the economy immune from the manipulations of knaves. A couple of knaves were invited into the debate presided over by Churchill prior to making the gold standard return decision, and one of them was John Maynard Keynes. And Holmes recounts how Keynes conceded in that debate held in Downing Street that a return to the gold standard was the only logical position for the British government to take in the wake of World War I and the economic dislocations that followed. That didn't keep Keynes, however, from writing The Economic Consequences of Mr. Churchill, a pamphlet published by Leonard and Virginia Woolf in 1925, which set out the slap-in-the-face hypothesis. And Holmes writes, "Claiming moral high ground for arguments that had failed the test of the possible was to become typical of the Bloomsbury Group and its many self-regarding successors." How true that is of the progressives and the left that we've encountered in the United States in the wake of the rest of the 20th century. 25 years later in Churchill's career, Holmes recounts how Churchill had to face the exigencies of war, and he succumbed to the blandishments of those who saw in the need of the British to respond to the war the responsibility to impose some pretty strict regulations on British society. I offer this paragraph from Holmes' book as an allegory for our time. "The regime was contaminated by niggling measures designed to harass the better off, whose assets had already been appropriated and whose incomes were heavily taxed. Everything save conscience can now be conscripted in this country," wrote the great American reporter and Anglophile Ed Murrow. "Consciences not proving stern enough, profits were officially banned, and the result was a black market, leading to food wardens and an increase in official intrusiveness that eroded the solidarity between people and state in whose name the measures were decreed. Winston's instincts were against this, as they were against repressive acts in general. It is unlikely that he ever knew the extent to which the war was used to justify gratuitous bureaucratic tyranny, and clearly he did not suspect what a permanent feature it would become. The great paradox of Churchill's public life is that in defense of freedom, he presided over the greatest and most irrevocable shift of power from the citizen to the state in British history. Does that have warning value for us in these first years of the 21st century? Perhaps it does. Yet there's hope, and a ray of hope is in the room, and that ray of hope comes to us directly from Washington, D.C., with some report of triumph over the bureaucratic maze in the field of energy in our domestic economy, about which more you will hear momentarily. I had dinner, and only briefly, I had dinner last night with you and with a group of students, including a law student from Marquette University here in Milwaukee, Dan Sir. And Dan, would you join me? There he is. And Dan said to me in particular, he was so looking forward to the address today to us by Paul Ryan. And I said, why is that? And Dan Sir said to me the following words. Well, there's never been a president from Wisconsin before. I then asked Dan Sir to tell me what he knew about Paul Ryan. And what Dan Sir said to me was the following, ladies and gentlemen, I offer from the ranks of our student scholars here today, Exhibit A. Dan, tell us about the background of Paul Ryan.
Well, you know, a friend once described James Madison by saying, in him, the good genius of the country was personified. I think if you look at Paul Ryan, you'll see in him, the goodness and genius of Wisconsin was personified. Whether it's raising his three young children as diehard Packer fans, or as a sportsman. He's five generations deep in Wisconsin, went to the University of Miami in Ohio, got his bachelor's degree in economics, went out to D.C., worked for then U.S. Senator Bob Caston, and then Congressman Sam Brownback as a legislative director, went over to Empower America, wrote speeches for Bill Bennett and Jack Kemp, came back to Wisconsin in 1998 to win the first congressional district of Wisconsin. He has built on his margins in that district ever since, and serves on the Joint Economic Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. And he is Wisconsin's rising, but already shining brightly, star.
Dan, thank you very much. And if a guy, you know, you just push the button in a law student and get that enthusiasm, this must be some guy. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's with great pleasure the Philadelphia Society welcomes Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin.